Thank you again, Pastor. How many of you were in the first service? Most of you. Well, I'm glad. So I told you how things got started. In the Sunday School Hour, I want to talk about some other crises and problems that came up that were not quite so dramatic, but were very important. You'll understand that in the eyes of the Sahrawi people, I was not a poor missionary struggling. I was a multimillionaire in their eyes. Because an airplane would come and land on the river, a float plane, and would bring cases of steel axes, 1,500 gram steel axes, 3 dozen axe heads in a wooden box. And that meant I had enough wooden steel axes to purchase 30 or 40 wives if I wanted them. And I had a little black box attached to a 12-volt battery, and I could press a button and talk to this little thing I was holding my hand, and the pilot would hear it way beyond the horizon and would answer me. And so the Sahrawi people thought, and Stone Age people, that little box, there's a little man inside it, has amazing knowledge. He can tell Tuan Don, that's me, exactly when the float plane is going to come and land on the river. And one man came up to me and said, "Don, last night someone stole my bananas out of the edge of the jungle. Please ask the little man in the box who did it." And we had, in addition to steel axes, machetes and knives with 6-inch blades. And please understand, if you've grown up in the Stone Age using stone axes, you'd soon realize the first time you use a steel axe, that even the dullest steel axe is a vast technological improvement over the sharpest stone axe. So, how did you feel when you got your first automobile? Was that an amazing day for you? You owned your own automobile. For a Sahrawi man to own a 1,500 gram steel axe head that he could mount on a wooden handle, that was equivalent to your first automobile. So they thought I was amazingly rich, and in addition to steel tools, had supplies of medicine and nylon fish line. They'd never heard of fish line. Steel fish hooks were a new thing to them. And the airplanes also brought in salt in 40-pound sacks. Now, the Sahrawi people live in a hot, humid climate. They work hard to survive. And they perspire, they lose salt, and they do not have a supermarket to go and buy salt to renew the salt that they need for their metabolism. So they crave salt. There is a kind of an ash that has a salty taste. I don't know if it's real salt or not, but that's the closest they ever came, and you had to find that particular kind of plant and burn it just the right way so the ashes of it would have a salty taste. But we had 40-pound bags of salt. We also had blocks of soap. Now, please try to imagine that you are, let's say, 40, 50 years of age. You have bathed in the river, but just water without soap does not remove the pig grease, does not remove the soot from the fire that you've been sleeping next to for years. So you're not really clean. You think you're clean, but you're not. The first time you bathe with soap and you wash that soap off your skin, you feel strange. It's amazing, the different feeling after you bathe with soap. And so people were exclaiming, "This makes me feel so different. This is wonderful. It's like an addiction." So once a few people experience soap, then more and more people want soap. Now also, the Sahrawi women were modest because they wore grass skirts. Nothing up top, but they did wear grass skirts. All the boys and girls wore nothing. They just ran about naked. And the Sahrawi men were naked. They wore nothing except a few ornaments that didn't cover very much. So this was something to get used to. But you do get used to it. After a while, it's just part of the scenery. You don't even notice it. Now, some missionaries would try to shame naked men for being naked and say, "This is bad, this is sinful." But we did not think, they needed steel tools and medicine and other things more than they needed to cover their loins with a piece of cloth. So we gave the priority to making these things available for them. And we thought somehow we're going to have to tackle the problem of nakedness, because the part of New Guinea where they lived became a part of Indonesia, and Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim nation. And do Muslims accept people walking around naked? The Muslim religion requires you have to be covered even more than Western society demands. So if these men continue to be naked and Muslim policemen and soldiers armed with guns would come in, this was going to be a major culture shock for the incomers, and they would certainly make life difficult for the Sahwi. So they had to accept the clothing as a necessity for their future adaptability in a Muslim context. And so we were praying and pondering, how are we going to make them sure? Because initially they didn't see any need to wear clothing like I did. They thought that's the Tuan way. Our way is different. Well, we didn't have to worry about it, because other tribes that lived a little closer to government outposts began to take a leg of pork and sell it to someone and got paid a pair of shorts. So more and more men from neighboring tribes were wearing these colorful shorts. And so when some Sahwi men who are naked are paddling in their canoe along the river and they meet a canoe with maybe a dozen men that are all wearing shorts, what do those men with shorts say to the Sahwi? Look at you, you jungle bunnies. You're naked. You don't realize this is the way men are supposed to look nowadays. You're out of touch. So Sahwi men began coming to me and saying, Don, I worked for you and I got an axe, a machete, a knife. But can I work again? I want a pair of shorts because the other tribes are laughing at us. So it was not, we didn't need to say anything. Peer pressure from other tribes took care of it. But of course, an anthropologist would say, that missionary, he made them feel that they had to change their culture, wear clothes. Well, it wasn't us. It was something inevitable. And so, and I've sometimes gotten to speak to an anthropology class in a university setting, and often the professor has given all his anti-missionary propaganda to the class, and he said, I've got a missionary coming, and you can ask him all kinds of embarrassing questions, okay? But I know I'm expecting that. So I say things like, the world is simply not big enough anymore for any culture to be left in isolation permanently. Encroachment is inevitable. So the question, can they be left unchanged, is obsolete. The more important question is, will the most sensitive agents of change get there first to prepare them for an inevitable onslaught of maybe terrorist groups who will force men to join and fight with them, or force them to provide food and lodging for terrorists, or it may be drug dealers coming in and paying them to grow drugs that they can sell, giving them drugs to protect the drug crop, all kinds of terrible things. Or it may be just people coming in introducing venereal disease. And so the people, indigenous people, who've been living in isolation are in grim danger. And if a sensitive agent of change does not get there first, the exploiters will get there. And many tribes have been pushed over the brink into total extinction because a missionary didn't get there first. So I say these things, and I see the students looking at the professor at the back and saying, hey, wait a minute, this is giving us a rather different view of missionaries. Seems like they are doing something that's very important out there. But coming back to the view, there's 3,000 of the Sahwi and just three of us, and one of us is less than a year old. And we do not have glass on our windows and no steel bars, just green plastic fly screen. So what are all these men who have a very strong desire for steel tools and fish line and fish hooks and bars of soap and salt, what are they going to be sorely tempted to do after we've fallen asleep, turned out the 500 candle power pressure lamp, and blown out the candle in the bedroom? What are they going to be tempted to do? cut the fly screen, come in and steal. And if that happens once, what am I going to do? Can I call a policeman? The nearest policeman is 80 river miles away. And he warned me, if you are foolish enough, young man, to take your wife and your baby son that far beyond the range of my protection, you deserve whatever happens to you. And I said, well, thank you for the warning, but being eaten by cannibals is a missionary's occupational hazard, so we will live or die with that. So there was no police protection. And so I knew someone would be tempted to break in and steal. And here was another problem I became aware of. When a missionary comes into a community, he's the newcomer. He's got to build his house, unless he can buy one or rent one, which I certainly needed to build my own. And he needs help. And he needs to build a fence around his yard. He's planting things. He's planting banana plants and papaya plants and his own pineapple garden and a lemon tree. And so he's got to build a fence so the pigs do not uproot these things before they have time to bear a crop. And so he's got to have people chop boards that will be of durable wood to make the fence. He's got to make a clothesline for his wife to hang out the laundry to dry. And he's going to want to be buying food from the people. And so there's lots of jobs needing to be done. Who's available to be hired to do these jobs and get paid by these things I mentioned? Young single men are so available. The older men, they have families to care for. They have to go out and hunt wild pigs. They've got to chop down the right kind of tree and take months to hollow it out with stone tools to make it into a dugout canoe. They're busy guys. So I find that here I am hiring these young single men that are hanging there. They're in the yard outside the door waiting for me to call them. Will you please do this? Will you cut the grass for me? Here's a machete, cut the grass. Or do this or do that. And so I sensed that I was bonding with these young single men, but having almost no interaction with the elders. And these young single men working for me were learning to hold and make use of tools that the elders had never seen or never learned to use, beginning to learn words from the national language. And with the information, the knowledge they were gradually gaining from me as they served for me, they were beginning to get kind of uppity and acting kind of smart and beginning to look down on the elders. And I thought, I am unwittingly in the process of overturning the authority system in this culture, and I don't like that. So I began to pray, Lord, please give me some way to let the older men know that they matter. Because if the older men do not become believers and are not going to be part of the church that is to be established, is it going to be a healthy church? Will it be more healthy if it's inclusive of the older age groups, not just the young? So that was a prayer request. All right. One evening, Carol and I had read the mail that a missionary pilot had brought in. We got mail only about once a month, and took 6 weeks for letters from our family back in the USA and Canada to reach us. So we're catching up in the mail. Then we turned out the 500 candle power kerosene burning lamp. Have any of you ever used a pressure lamp? A few of you. Yeah, older ones, I guess. So we retired for the night, got under the mosquito net. You always tuck the edge of the mosquito net under the edge of the mattress. Why? Just in case a cold thing may come sliding in under the edge of the mosquito net and wake you up with its chilly body, a snake or a lizard of some kind. So we tucked the mosquito net under the edge of the mattress. Carol had fallen asleep. I was almost asleep when I heard the floorboard squeak on the porch by the back door. So I thought, somebody has climbed up on the porch. If it's a medical emergency, they will call and we'll get up and go see, is it something that has to be taken care of immediately or can it wait till morning? But nobody called. So I thought, this is suspicious. So I took my flashlight. You all always have a flashlight with you in bed. I did not turn the flashlight on, but I got out from under the mosquito net and with the flashlight in my hand, walked down the hallway. By this time, I had added a three-bedroom extension to one side of the thatch box because we had another baby on the way, and there'll probably be another one after that. So I was getting ready for an increased family. Walked down the hallway to see who was standing in the dark on the back porch. Well, a board squeaked under my foot, and I thought, whoever's on the back porch may have heard that. So looking at an angle out through a window of the hallway, I saw two shadowy figures who were standing on the back porch jump down and run toward one of the three villages, the one that was to the north of our home. So I thought they heard me coming. They jumped down and ran. They were planning on cutting the fly screen, coming in and stealing. So I thought, this is a crisis moment. So I turned the flashlight on and saw that the ground was wet and the steps were dry and they had left wet footprints on the step. So I thought, forensic evidence. Then I stood there asking God, how am I going to deal with this? If I walk down to the village that those two men fled to, I can stand in the middle of the village and start shouting and telling everybody what I saw and ranting and complaining. When you're sick, we give you free medicine, and this is how you're going to treat us. You're going to break in and steal from me. So as I was wondering how I should respond to this first threat of thievery, I just felt the Lord whispering to me, saying, Don, don't you see what I provided you with here? You've been asking for an opportunity to let the elders know that they matter. This is it. Now, it's one thing to pray, but it's another thing to recognize God's answer to the prayer when it's right there in front of you, right? Sometimes we get an answer and we don't recognize it. But I said, yes, 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 that's what I have to do. So I walked down to the middle of the village that those two men had fled to, and I had no idea who they were. I just knew they were pretty young, spry guys to be able to jump off the porch the way they did. I stood, and people were all up in their tree houses, some 10 feet above the ground, some 15, 20 feet above the ground. Occasionally, they would make them 40 feet above the ground. And so I called the name of an elder in each of those houses of Kamur village. I said, Sati, Numu, Hato, Mairach, Sinfafim, please come down, we need to talk. So they were probably just finishing their evening meal of sago and pork. They looked at me and said, what's the matter? And I said, come down, I need to show you something. So they all came down the ladders and I led them to the back porch and showed them the wet footprints on the back porch. And then I said, I saw two young men who were planning on breaking in and stealing from me. When they heard me coming, they jumped down and ran to your village. So there's two young men in your village who are planning on stealing from me. So we have a problem here. And I want to ask you, elders, can I entrust this problem to you? You are men of authority. Can I put it in your hands? Will you take care of this and warn the young that this must not ever happen again? Well, those elders looked at me and they looked at each other, and I could almost read their thoughts. They were thinking, this multimillionaire is admitting his vulnerability and asking us for help. And so they said, Don, you've asked for our help. You've got it. We will take care of this. So they turned around and walked back to the village, and they took turns lecturing everybody in the village, and those two men, whoever they were probably sitting there trying to be unnoticed, thinking someone's going to say, you just came in. Was it you two guys? I do not know who they were, but I didn't need to know. So with the lecture that the elders gave, then there was no stealing. Carol and I lived among the Sawi for 15 years with nothing but fly screen on our windows. We'd sometimes be gone for as many as 4 weeks at a time come back, it was never cut. They did not steal. And the elders were my buddies because I asked for their help and trusted them to be able to take care of a problem. Then I was going to have some big projects. Like there was a place, there were these two main rivers that were flowing east and west, from east to west and emptying into the ocean. And there were two rivers that came to smaller tributaries of those two main rivers that came to within 3 miles of each other. So I would go by canoe to the end of the one tributary and walk 3 miles through dense jungle and hope that I'd have a canoe at the end of the other tributary, but sometimes it wouldn't be there. Someone would say, oh, here's a canoe, I need it, I'll use it. So it was kind of uncertain that I would find my canoe that I'd purchased and left there for my use. Then I'd have to find some other way without a canoe to get down to the villages on that other main river. So I thought, you know, it would really make things more efficient if I would hire maybe 100 men and provide them with shovels and axes to cut tree roots, because there's no stones. You don't have to worry about stones, just soil. It's just silt from some ancient ocean bed, I guess. And I'll cut a 3-mile-long canal to connect these two tributaries and connect these two rivers. So I can just go back and forth in one canoe and preach the gospel much more frequently in the villages on that other river. So I hired 100 men, and I gave the elders a warning ahead of time so they could store up extra food for their families so they could take part in these major projects. So they got axes, they got machetes, they got short. Oh, and by the way, a ladies group from one of our supporting churches in Victoria, British Columbia, west coast of Canada, sent us a letter saying, we've got a sewing group, and if there's any need for clothing, we can sew them and send several hundred pieces of clothing out there for you. Give us something to do. So the Sawi men by this time were asking, said, please, I need a pair of shorts. I don't like being laughed at by the other tribes. So we asked that sewing group, and they sent us several hundred red and blue and green men's shorts with a drawstring. And that came just at the right time. So if that problem of, you know, had not, if God had not given me wisdom how to deal with the threat of thievery, because if it happened, oh, and then there's another problem. What if someone didn't steal but got the idea they could just pressure us into giving them things free? So I had set the precedent. If you are sick, you can come to the clinic that I've built for my wife and she will give you free medicine, no charge. But if you want anything else, soap, salt, fish line, fish hooks, clothing, whatever, a flashlight and batteries for the flashlight, you have to work. Because suppose that a missionary might think, I've got so much and they're so poor. Oh, I can't stand to be so rich and then be so poor. I've got to give them things free. So if you give, let's say you give 6 free steel axes to 6 men, what's going to happen? Hundreds of men are going to come saying, we want that too. Oh, no, I don't have enough for all of you, just for them. Oh, okay, so you love those 6 men, you don't love us, well, we don't love you either. So you can cause turmoil by misguided charity. And there's a bigger problem. Were these Sawi men very self-reliant? Did they know how to survive in a jungle where I would perish in a week? Yes. They knew how to carve dugout canoes out of trees, build tree houses, and kill wild pigs. And every one of them was a trained naturalist who could give you the names of hundreds of species of flora and fauna and the dangers or usefulness of every single thing. Amazing wisdom and self-reliance. And to change men who are self-reliant like that into quibbling beggars would be a travesty, a terrible disservice. So they had to work. And this was the precedent. That's obviously the way it is. They all accepted it. Then a problem arose because a Roman Catholic priest working in a tribe 30, 40 miles further inland a different tribe called the Aoyu. The word was that he was there, and three Sawi men who could speak the Aoyu language decided they wanted to go and check out this other Tuan. Tuan is what they call it, a European. So they went there, and they stood in the yard of the house that the pastor, as they called him, had built for himself. And those three Sawi men watched as a man of the Aoyu tribe climbed up the steps on the priest's front porch and said, "Pastor, I need a new knife. The blade of my knife broke." Free knife. Another one, "Pastor, the thorns are tearing my shorts. Please, can I have a new pair of shorts?" Free pair of shorts. "Pastor, could I have a t-shirt?" Free t-shirt. So the Sawi men saw this man giving all these things free. And they asked the Aoyu men, "Do you mean he gives you all these things free?" "Yes, of course he does," the Aoyu said. "Doesn't your missionary do that for you?" "No, he makes us work for everything except medicine." "Oh, you got the wrong kind of missionary. You got a Protestant missionary. You need a Roman Catholic missionary like we got." Now, I think this may have been staged. I don't know. I don't need to know, but I can't imagine that he was actually rich enough to keep doing that all the time. I think someone may have told him, "There's three men from the Sawi tribe are here where there's a Protestant missionary, and so let's make that Protestant missionary look bad." Perhaps he was too ethical for that. I don't know. Maybe he did give things away free. But anyway, those three Sawi men said, "When we get back home, we got to talk to our Tuan Don." So they came back and called me out, and I said, "What's up?" So they described for me what they had seen. And then they asked me, "We want to know, is the pastor able to give the Aoyu men all those things free because he's richer than you? Or is it that he loves them more than you love us?" So I thought, here's another moment of crisis. If I do not give the right answer and the word spreads that I can be pressured, cajoled, coaxed into giving things free, life will become untenable here. It'll be a misery because everybody will be begging. And they'll lose their self-reliance. I will have established a nanny state in the jungle. So I prayed for wisdom. And thank God it was there. I knew what I needed to say. I said to those three men, "I'm going to tell you why the pastor gives the Aoyu men all those things free. It's because when he looks at them, he does not see them as men. He sees them as children. Doesn't he even ask them to call him father?" "Yes, he does." "Right." So he sees them as children. And that's what you do with children. You give them things free because they're just kids. Now I'm going to tell you why I require you to work for anything you want from me. It's because when I look at you, I see men. You are men. Am I right? You are men, aren't you? "Yeah, of course, we're men. I thought so." "Then you'll work." "Yes, we'll work." It was settled. The word spread. They did not want me to think of them as children. So is this giving you some idea as how to pray for missionaries, especially if they're in tribal settings like that? You not only have to know the gospel really well and know how to preach it, and know the language well and understand the culture, you got to be a psychologist and an expert in commerce. Because I had to assign the relative value for a 1,500-gram steel axe head and a machete and a knife and a roll of fish line of a certain length and how much for a fish hook, and a bar of soap. And so whatever I said was the price, that's what they accepted. So I was an economist and a house builder and a school builder and probably built 16 structures out there of various kinds and dug that 3-mile-long canal and carved an airstrip out of the jungle because there was only one float plane but 6 wheel planes. So if you had an airstrip that a wheel plane could land on, you could get much more frequent service. That's my little warning. So any questions? Oh, and a translator as well, translating New Testament, and a literacy teacher. Yes, ma'am. Well, if you're thinking of people that are still living in the Stone Age, there may not be more than 200 small groups left in the Amazon jungle, the jungles of New Guinea, some remote parts of Africa, but unreached in the sense of not having a resident witness for the gospel speaking their language. We were talking very large numbers a few years ago, and then we brought it down to 7,000, and it's reduced much below that. There's a book about this called The World Christian Handbook, and they keep bringing up a new edition about every 3 or 4 years. So ask for the latest edition, and that will give you up-to-date figures. Sir? My calling? He wants to know about my calling. When did I know that I was called to be a missionary? Well, I began praying at 9 years of age, even though I didn't understand the gospel yet. I just knew about now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before awake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. That was about the limit of. But I, when I was very sick with pneumonia, my father, who was a nominal Episcopalian, or Anglican as they say in Canada, came into the hospital room and said, "Don, you're very sick, and I'm asking God to make you well, but I want you to ask God to make you well." And he explained about prayer. So in the oxygen tent, I prayed, "God, I'm sick. Would you please make me well?" And I had this, you know, understanding of an invisible, present everywhere being who was kind and could be asked for help. So that was about the limit. But when adults kept asking me at 9 years of age, "What are you going to be when you grow up?" I got tired of saying, "I don't know." Because they say, "Well, you got to think about these things, lad. You're 9 years old." So I thought, I guess I'm supposed to know. And I tried to make up my mind, couldn't make up my mind. So I decided this is another question worthy of God. So I decided to pray and ask God to help me find out what I should be. So I knelt down by the windowsill and prayed, "God, it's me again. My name is Donnie. When I was sick, I asked you to make my well, and you did. That was kind, but I got another problem. Everybody's asking me what I'm going to be when I grow up, and I'm tired of saying, I don't know. Would you please help me find out what it is so I can tell them?" And then with further thought, I said, "I hope it's something really interesting." And I felt peace on my knees. I knew he heard me. So from that time on, when people would ask me that question, instead of saying, "I don't know," I'd look them in the eye and say, "I don't know yet." Fast forward, I'm 17 years of age. I come in contact with people who really knew the Lord, young men and women my own age, and I came to Christ through their influence, and then was invited to a summer camp meeting out in the woods, and there was a missionary from somewhere in Africa preaching about being a missionary. And I was not very impressed with him as a speaker because he had no eye contact with his audience, kept his eyes closed as if looking at us would distract him from hearing what the Holy Spirit was saying. But he kept saying the greatest privilege any Christian can ever have is to be chosen of God to bring the gospel to an entire tribe or community or nation or city or province or state where the gospel has never been proclaimed. Ask God to give you that privilege, and he will answer and lead you. And as I sat there, I remembered praying that prayer, and suddenly I knew the presence of God was saying, "Don, I've waited until now. I had to call you to put your faith in my son. Now I'm calling you to serve him, to take the gospel somewhere in the world. Will you do this for me?" And I said, "Yes, I will." It was settled. I had no idea where it would be, but I knew God was going to lead me somewhere in the world, and I proclaimed the gospel to people who had never heard of Jesus. And of course, at 17 years of age, I was getting interested in girls, and I thought, uh-oh, I'm going to be a missionary. There's probably not very many pretty girls willing to marry a man who's going to go to a wild frontier someday somewhere, so maybe part of the cost is I'll never get married. But I prayed again, and I said, Lord, if somewhere there's a woman who loves you at least as much as I do and is willing to serve you anywhere in the world that you would choose, and if you know that I'm right for her and she's right for me, would you please somehow triangulate us together? That's a mathematical term. And enable us to recognize each other when we meet and fall in love and get married. I would sure appreciate it. If she could be really pretty, that would be nice too. Are these little add-ons to my prayers? And God answered that. I went to Prairie Bible Institute, and Carol went all the way up from Enid, Oklahoma, to be in the same class. And the school had rules, no dating until your senior year. And even then, it had to be chaperoned. I mean, this was like the missions equivalent of a Marine boot camp. Not that everybody should live by those rules, but if you're going to be a missionary, you got to be self-disciplined. So all these rules. There was a joke that they had pink and blue sidewalks, and then a girl was expelled for having a hole in the knee of her bathing suit. These were just jokes. But you can smile when you can't say a word. They even had two completely outfitted libraries, one for the guys, one for the gals. And the girls went shopping Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and the guys went shopping the other days of the week. Prairie Bible is now called Prairie Bible College, with Ellie Maxwell, the principal, and what a preacher and teacher of the Word of God he was. And it's famous for missionaries going out. And mission representatives came to plead for graduates of the school to volunteer to serve with this mission, that mission in this nation, that nation. And as a result of listening to all those missionary representatives, I felt called to a different mission field about every 3 months. But finally, God sent a 75-year-old Englishman, Ebenezer G. Vine, with his Oxford accent. And he stood there with his spectacles down the bridge of his nose, looked out at 700 Bible college students, and roared, "Netherlands, New Guinea!" and began to talk about this new open field. And I met with him and signed on with what was then called Regions Beyond Missionary Union, now called World Team. Yes, sir.
Did you tell us something about
the perspective course? Yes. Originally, the invitation for me to come to Asheville was not to speak here. This was a very wonderful, delightful add-on, but to have a meeting with pastors, Christian workers, evangelists, in this community, this area, to stir up interest in a course called Perspectives on the World Christian Movement. That's the long name. The short name is just Perspectives. Initiated by a Presbyterian, Dr. Ralph Winter, who served as a missionary in Guatemala and then became a professor of missions at Fuller School of World Missions, Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, California. And then there was a campus, 17-acre campus, was offered for sale in Pasadena because the campus was moving from there to San Diego. The college moved and left that campus. So he, in faith, undertook to purchase that and succeeded. $13 million was raised. And it became the United States Center for World Mission. And Dr. Ralph Winter was the one who heard me tell the Peace Child story, one of the first times I ever told it. And he said, "Don, this has got to be published as a book. Will you please write a book?" And I said, "Publishers are not looking for unknown authors. So if I take time to write a book and it's not going to be published, that's a waste of my time." He said, "Is that all that's bothering you?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I own a publishing company. If you write it, I guarantee it will be published." And I said, "Really? You've got my attention, Dr. Winter." His publishing house was William Carey Library. But he said, "My publishing house is a small one. I am going to recommend, before you even write one paragraph of your story, I'm going to recommend to the owner of a publishing house that's larger that he will publish it. But if he says no, then I will publish it." So I said, "Thank you. I'll start writing." So I flew back home. We were getting ready to fly back out for a second term on the field. And I just got home and half unpacked my suitcase. The telephone rang, and it was Dr. Ralph Winter. He said, have you unpacked? I said, partially. He said, pack up again. You're coming straight back down here tomorrow morning. And I said, why? The publisher that I mentioned is interested. He wants to hear you tell the story. He's going to have you speak at a chapel to the publishing staff tomorrow morning. So I actually had to fly down that same day. And so I met and spoke and told the story. They all sat there and invited me in, thinking if he can write half as well as he can talk, I guess we can edit it and make it publishable. So they gave me a signed contract the very next morning. So I was on my way to becoming an author. And so writing, and I also like to paint pictures of the people I write about. So if you have time to go to the fellowship hall, you can look at some paintings I've done of Sawi people doing things that are important to them, and also the mountain tribes that I wrote about in a book called Lords of the Earth. Goes into depth with the travail of some of my colleagues reaching out to one of the mountain tribes, and they killed and devoured two of my world team colleagues back in 1968. And whereas Peace Child and Lords of the Earth each take you into depth in one culture per book, this gives you 28 stories from around the world and down through history of things that God has placed in cultures ahead of time to facilitate response to the message of the gospel, and an in-depth study of Islam. We cannot afford to be indifferent or ignorant about Islam in this generation. We need to understand it. Thousands of hours of research went into writing this book. Thank you all.